she's going to tell us a little bit about the program and about her experience in it.
Yes. So. Thank you. I appreciated the opportunity to be able to reflect. And a year is a long time. It's a year-long program. And the first meeting we met, we would meet once a month for a full day, and we had 11 meetings. And I'll tell you some more about the components of the program. But the first meeting we got together and started all these handouts, you know, what chaplaincy is, what a chaplain is. And one of the articles, the first article, was some third graders were asked what a chaplain is. And I think they had better answers than what I knew what a chaplain was a year ago. They said that a chaplain is someone who knows how to pray. A chaplain is a preacher who works in the prisons to tell the prisoners what is wrong and what is right. A chaplain is the one who goes with soldiers in a war so they won't be scared. The chaplain is the woman who stayed with my family when my grandmother died in the hospital. That was pretty good, diverse group of answers, and probably was a bit more than I knew what a chaplain was when I started looking into the program. The term chaplain comes from way back the Middle Ages, the seventh century. It's when it's from the word capella, and it's the black cloak of the priest. And the capellas, the chaplains, were priests that were assigned to chapels versus their own church. Eventually it was expanded that they would do special services, they would go to war. They were the ones protecting the relics in the war with their black cloaks. In modern times, they're mostly associated with, again, going to war, where a service was where people needed spiritual care when they weren't at home. And today, you can find chaplains in hospitals, jails, airports. I thought that was very interesting. Pretty much any place that you will find people that may be in need of spiritual care. And when I first said airport, I'm like, but think about it. People are traveling all over the world for some reason or not. So that was very interesting. Traditionally, it had always been that a chaplain was sanctioned or endorsed by their religion or the church that they belong to. And it's only been recently that chaplains have been certified as discipline chaplains. And there's been very, very few Buddhist chaplains. In fact, chaplain, there is no such word in Buddhism for a chaplain. So again, here we are in America expanding what the definition is and what we need for our communities. I started asking what chaplaincy was about when I started asking Angie and people I respected about how I could serve better my community. And it came also at a time I have been doing life coaching for many years, and I have been volunteering for several years. So between my private clients and the clients that I was working with volunteering, after that I helped them get their resume and they applied for the job that they wanted, or they got a plan for their dream that they always wanted to succeed, or as a bereavement counselor, you know, working through building the rapport and talking to me about the actual death, it always seemed to come back to a level of a need for a language of the sacred, or wanting to get beyond what was apparent into something that around the spiritual. And when I go to my training books and coaching and bereavement, there's no chapter on spiritual care in my training books or coaching books. So I started to become very interested in chaplaincy. What is it? I think the other very strong experience that shaped my decision to become a chaplain or investigate about becoming a chaplain happened in May of 2004. At the time, of course, I didn't know that it was, I mean, I knew that it was affecting me in a way, but I didn't realize that it was another signpost to go down this way towards looking into chaplaincy. In May of 2004, my grandmother had suffered a series of small strokes. And I went to go visit her in way up in Butte County. It's bankrupt, about 4 hours north of here in a local hospital, and she's laying there. And I come in, grab her hand, and as I'm discerning whether she knew that I was there and if she knew who I was, she said, Jeanette? No, Grandma, it's me, Donna Lynn. Jeanette is my mother, and she'll be here later today. And all I could say, you know, right then, you know, was like, oh, Grandma, everything's going to be okay. And you know when you get this feeling in your body, like, boy, that's stupid, you know? Like, that is like an outright lie. That's like the stupidest thing you could ever say. It wasn't okay. I mean, she had thought that she had been kidnapped by sailors, get this, sailors, and was in a spaceship. So she's obviously confused. She was paralyzed, basically. She couldn't move and was in pain. This was not okay. Things were not probably going to be all right again. She was dying. And I just felt very unskillful. You know, I've forgiven myself several times, and as I was thinking about this again, I had to forgive myself again because I didn't know how to be skillful. And I knew that it was okay as a granddaughter to hold my grandmother's hand and say it's going to be okay, but I also knew that that's not really what she probably needed. About a week or two later, when I again traveled up north and I grabbed her hand again and, you know, and said, Grandma, I'm here, I love you, as she was dying, in the active process of dying. And, you know, she's never died before. She didn't know how to do it, and you can tell she was scared. And I didn't know, you know, about dying, neither did a couple other members of the family that were there. And I just kept holding her hand for 4 days, pretty much the whole time, telling her how much I loved her. And she couldn't let go either. I couldn't let go. And again, I could only do the only thing I knew at the time to do, but I knew that there was a more skillful way of going about this. And she died within a couple hours after I left to go back home, which I've learned is a common thing that happens. So in a sense, that experience, other than the need of feeling a desire to serve better, formed my aspiration to be more skillful in providing spiritual care and being with people at the end of life and being with people in grief and working with people in with loss. And in fact, the chaplaincy program was inspired, that sounds weird, it was created in the wake of September 11th. Paul Holler and Gil Fronstahl, the two of the founding members, along with Jennifer Block, saw that there was a need in their community, by their students and by people they knew, to want to do something to help people. They wanted to serve. They wanted to do something in a very authentic and deep way that was connected with their practice. And so they designed this chaplaincy program. This is the, I was in the fourth class, the fourth year class. Kathy Wilden was like in the first one along with Diana Deering, who is in our Sangha also. They were in the first class. The class, let me start off first. Paul Holler is currently the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, and he has a very long history of working in prisons and working with the homeless. He was born in Ireland, no stranger to suffering. He studied in Asia, and actually at one point was a Theravadan student, serious student, and then came to San Francisco, and he was ordained as a priest and transmitted, I believe, by Mel Wiseman. Wiseman. Gil, very similar history. Gil was the primary teacher at Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City. He authored the book that we studied here, the Dhammapada. So he was the one that translated that. He also studied in Asia and came back to San Francisco and was ordained by Richard Baker, I think, and then left the Soto heritage and came to be the primary teacher and founded IMC, the Insight Meditation Center. Very wonderful, very, just very wonderful, great scholar. And Jennifer Block is a young woman, and she is a certified Buddhist chaplain, has a master's in divinity, and is the director of education at the Zen Hospice Project. So the three of them constructed this program. It's a year-long program, 11 meetings, around the 10 paramas. We call them the paramitas. The Mahayana tradition that we have took the 10 and consolidated them into 6. But I thought it was very clever to have each meeting around a parami. Part of the class was the meetings. We were asked to do 100 hours of volunteer chaplaincy work in that year. We had a book plus readings every month along with one or two assignments, writing assignments. We had meetings with the teachers every other month, a meeting with our own peer groups every month. It's a little more work than I thought. And it was all grounded in the practice, though. The program was designed for people that had a dedication to the practice, and the criteria for the program was that you have at least 4 years with a practice, recommendation from a teacher, sit a few shashins and fill out their application. This is how you got into the program. Looking back, on this last year, the participants, looking back, of what were the benefits of the program. One of the benefits, or one of the bonuses that I got, was that I met all these wonderful, inspiring people in the group. So there's about 20 of us. Buddhists from the Tibetan, many of the Tibetan lineages, the Vipassana practice, and different Zen traditions. Many from Soto Zen up in San Francisco. And in fact, there were, several ordained priests that lived up there that were in the class. And it was just really it was inspiring. It was very heartfelt. It's like sitting in a room like this and knowing that every one of them was dedicated to serving in their community somewhere and somehow. Several people went to teach meditation at San Quentin. Another woman, Margaret, teaches meditation over here at Elmwood. There were several that worked in Laguna Hospital, which is where Zen Hospice is, working on the AIDS ward, working on different wards. One of the guys, worked on a closed ward of mentally unstable folks that virtually had spent their whole lives in this one ward locked up. A lot of them weren't even verbal, and he would go and provide spiritual care. It was just really amazing, and to hear the stories and share the stories. One of the interesting stories, Sharon, she's a stroke survivor and in a wheelchair. And her unexpected surprise from the program was going to San Quentin and finding out how comfortable she felt there. I find that very interesting. And so she is now going there as much often as that she can to meditate with the prisoners there. It's just really amazing. So that was a real bonus of the program that I hadn't counted on. So my learnings and aspirations from the program, it met my expectations as far as teaching me very concrete skills on how to become a chaplain, especially a Buddhist chaplain. When you go to a hospital, in fact, Kathy, who's been a chaplain at the Santa Cruz Hospital, is it Dominican, the hospital? She's been there like 4 or 5 years. Only once has she met a Buddhist. So the rest of the time, what is she doing? She's helping people, you know, with the Lord's Prayer, and she's honoring them. She's meeting the people where they're at in their time of need, and she is praying with them on who they need to pray to and what they need to pray for. In fact, that I think was one of my most interesting classes, of introducing prayer to this room of Buddhists. You should have just seen the body language and everything going on. Yeah! it was great. By then, my clients had already taught me how to pray. One gentleman I was helping prepare a resume for, he had a very severe learning disability, and he really wanted this job. We worked hard on his resume and did mock interviews and whatnot, and he pulled me aside into this conference room one day and closed the door, and I says, there's one more thing we've got to do for me to get this job. I'm like, okay, you know, what is this, Larry? And he grabs my hand and he points at my mall and he says, and he, by the way, he's Irish Catholic. And he points at my mall and says, I can see you're the same faith as I am. I'm going, you're Buddhist? Yeah, I'm thinking, you're Buddhist? Yeah, I'm like, grabs my hand and he just starts praying to, I think it was either, well, praying to who his favorite saint was. And I was just right there with him. And he taught me how to pray, just as a client I had at the Center for Living with Dying, which I have volunteered many hours with, sitting with individuals in grief. And I had the great fortune in this last year of leading groups of people in grief. One group specific, most was designed just for people that had lost their one of their parents. Another group is where they had lost a significant other. This one woman, she had she lost 14 relatives coming from Vietnam in a boat that ran into the pirates before they reached Malaysia. And she doesn't like Buddhists at all because the Buddhist in Malaysia wouldn't help them. And so she has a very deep... And again, she looked at me and said, I can tell that, you know, you pray just like I do. And grabs my hand again and teaches me how to pray. And to her, it was to Jesus and on and on, exactly what she needed. And she included me in her prayers too. But I really got a kick that day when we talked about prayers with all of these Buddhists. And our assignment that day was to come up with a prayer. And it was great fun. But think about the chant that we chanted tonight. Who was that to and who was that for? It's very sweet. We have our ways of praying in our tradition. One of the key learnings that I had that I'd like to share is around self-care. I think all of us are here because we care about things. And we know that when we sit, we're not just sitting for ourselves, we're sitting for everyone and everything. So self-care for people that serve, the boundaries sometimes can get blurred because serving is, for me, it warms my heart. Yet at the same time, no one can serve unless they take care of themselves. Intellectually, I've always got that. You know, we've all been on an airplane. You know, you grab the thing and you put it on yourself before you save the kid in the seat next to you. I mean, we all know that. But to actually take care of yourself, to accept yourself and to love yourself, again, you know, I'm not stupid. I got that. I read that before. But I totally get that the more that I take care of myself, the more I accept myself, the more I love myself, it is much easier to be with someone who is suffering and who's got things going on that maybe I've had judgments before. My capacity to have compassion and be with other people has expanded greatly by me truly getting and understanding what self-care is about and taking care of myself. Well, I could go on and on. The main... One other, you know, key thing, and this is what I think I could go on and on about, is that it seemed very natural to participate in the program as an extension of my practice. Serving is not fixing, it's not helping. The only way that we can truly serve is by being with and having our presence, with no judgment, no bias, meeting the people where they're at. And usually the people that you meet as a chaplain, they're usually in crisis. It's not... Spiritual care is easier when things are going well. Maybe. So I just feel really blessed to have this practice, and feels like that my life is so much more integrated, and being able to show up and to be able to serve and to be able to sit and have this practice. Anyway, thank you for letting me talk about it. And any questions, I'd be glad to make up an answer. I mean, give an answer of some sort.
Will you now act as a chaplain somewhere?
As volunteer, I can, and I'm working right now, actually volunteering in a hospice, a local hospice, Heartland Hospice, right now, and I'm going to continue there doing that. To be a, there's a little mystery about being a certified chaplain. It requires a master's in divinity and what they call CPEs, which is certified pastoral education or something. But as a volunteer, I can go many places, and hospice seems to be calling me right now. So thank you for asking.
One more.
Yeah.
If you knew someone who was going to meet a close relative who was dying, what advice would you now give them rather than the comment you spoke about?
Oh. Yeah. One of the experiences that I've had, being with people in crisis and being with people that are dying or that are in grief, is what a few of us call the low BS factor. And what that is people that are in pain, and I have found, have a low tolerance for someone not being authentic. Someone that is, again, saying everything will be okay. So if I were to give any advice, I'd just say be real as you can. Share what you really feel and see. And I've learned by doing that, so far no harm has been done. Jane. Well, all is well and good to talk about it. I've read a lot about it. And I've been with it. And I'm catching on that the way that we live is the way that we die. It'll be interesting to see how I face it. And I'm not going to say I'm... You know. Years ago, though, I couldn't... Another, maybe not so small thing why I aspire to do this work is my mother lost her father when she was a young child. And so in our household, we never, ever talked about death. We never talked about, you know, grief or any of this. And in fact, my mother could not visit her mother when she was dying. And in a way, that was part of my aspiration to be able to be there when other people cannot be, for whatever reason it is. So, my heart and got all wrapped up in my head, said something else, Jane. I don't think I've answered your question, but it's something about just showing up, and I hope I show up. If you know what I mean.